UFP, the United Federation of Podcasts.
Welcome to Franchise Fatigue, the little podcast on the United Federation of Podcast Network, where your hosts go through movies, remakes, and sequels. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me, as always, is my ever-constant co-host, Zach. Zach, I think I love you!
Hello, Brandon.
Hello, Zachy. How are you doing?
Good. I'm really glad that I found this exact same voice changer that some people had in another city a few years ago.
I mean, you can get them everywhere nowadays. I mean, it's an app on my phone now too, right? So, like, you can get them anywhere. They had cell phones back in the day, right?
This is much less impressive in the 20-teens than it was in the late 90s, I guess, to do the voice changing.
Yes. Well, we are continuing our coverage of the Scream franchise, and while we are recording this here, Scream 5 has been released, and I haven't had any spoilers yet, thank goodness, but you know, there's been some pretty positive reviews this weekend so far, so I'm excited and eager to go and see it. I know that we're a little bit behind. We normally try and match up our stuff with the theatrical runs, but this was just too close to Matrix for us to make it for the theatrical release of this one and have one out right away. But that's okay. That's okay. We'll come in a little later.
I have a prediction, Brennan. My prediction is Scream 5 will be better than Matrix 4.
No bet.
We'll see.
No bet.
Yeah, so I'm still watching these in order. So when I'm done with the fourth one, I'll go see the fifth one. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
but I've been avoiding spoilers, but there seems to be positive buzz and positive box office. So good for them.
Mm-hmm. Exciting. I'm still disappointed they didn't call it 5CREAM.
That really should have been.
Apparently, that's how they refer to it on set. Like, I saw a tweet from one of the creators. They called it Five Cream.
Five Cream. That's good. Set, so. Well, Scream 3, I mean, that's next time. But Scream 3 should have had a 3 for the E, you know? That would have made sense.
They weren't doing that kind of thing yet.
No, that was the head of the game. So that would have been too – even for this franchise, that would have been too far ahead of the game, I guess.
They could have called the fifth one Scream, a Scream story.
Or Screams.
Screams?
Yeah, yeah, maybe this movie could have been called Screams.
Yeah, that could have been. Anyways, well, let's jump into our discussion on Scream 2.
Let's do it. So Kevin Williamson had the idea for a sequel when he was writing the first Scream, and this movie actually began principal photography just 6 months after the release of the first one, and released less than a year after the first one. So that's a quick turnaround.
That is
and it's great. You see sequels that end up being rushed, or as we'll get into it here, like have to redo everything and they turn out okay. And then you see sequels that like wait like years and years to get it just right and they don't get it okay. So it's interesting that there's a lot of behind the scenes drama to this particular sequel we'll talk about here. Now, various titles were considered for Scream 2, including Scream Again, Scream Louder, and Scream the Sequel. I guess a reference to Airplane 2, the sequel, or, you know, Spaceballs, the, you know, fill in the blank, kind of that self-awareness there. But they actually filmed it under the title of Scream, the Sequel. And like you were mentioning, people wearing shirts and stuff on set for Scream 5. Scream, the Sequel is what people were wearing on shirts and hats for the crew when they were making Scream 2.
Just Scream. So that's like Revenge of the Jedi.
Exactly.
Yes.
So many of the actors and actresses in this movie had their own TV shows going on at the time. Neve Campbell, Courtney Cox, Sarah Michelle Gellar, and Jerry O'Connell. And so that made it complicated to schedule everyone. So Sarah Michelle Gellar was in between seasons of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but she had also just worked on I Know What You Did Last Summer, which was written by Kevin Williamson. And even though she was pretty busy, she agreed to be in this movie without reading a script because of the success of the first movie.
Why not, eh?
Right? It's like, yeah, sure, sure. It's like Star Wars or Batman or something. It's like, yeah, I don't need to read the script. Sign me up. What could go wrong? And those versions, anyway. I think it went right here, but we'll talk about it. So, Cece, Sarah Michelle Gellar's character, was supposed to appear in more scenes, including the one where all the sorority girls invite Sydney to the party. But I assume that was a scheduling conflict, so they just switched their lines out for some generic other sorority girl. And in the scene where she's running through the house, at one of the TVs you see Nosferatu, which is a reference to her being in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So I thought that was pretty clever. Now, Neve Campbell's schedule was pretty busy, too. She would shoot Party of Five, the TV show she was in, on Mondays and Tuesdays during the day, and spent Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday on this movie, most of which were night shoots. And then on Sunday, she would work all night until 6 a.m., go home, take a shower, and then immediately go to the Party of Five set, all without sleeping. That is insane. That reminds me of Michael J. Fox. When he did Back to the Future, he was on Growing Pains. And it was just like nonstop movie, TV, back and forth.
So I wonder if there's like a whole section of Party of Five where she's just not in it a lot. There must be, hey?
You would think so. Like for
2 days of shooting, that's it?
For her own well, maybe she was like in a coma or something for a few episodes. I never watched that show. I know of the show, but I never watched the show. So.
Yeah, I never did either.
And you have a big crush on Neve Campbell. You should check out that show. That's like years and years of Neve Campbell for you, Brandon.
I get too much stuff on my plate, man.
Now, there are references to both David Schwimmer and Jennifer Aniston, who starred in Friends with Courteney Cox. They actually make a little joke about like, oh, I saw those pictures of you naked. And she's like, oh, that was just my head on somebody else's body. That was apparently a controversy going on with, I think, about Jennifer Aniston at the time. So a lot of topical humor. And Denise Richards was offered a role in the film, but she was too busy doing Starship Troopers. Mm-hmm. So she would have fit in well as a sorority girl, I think.
I think so, too.
And all the actors who auditioned for the part of Derek, which went to Jerry O'Connell, had to perform the scene in the cafeteria where he sings, I Think I Love You. And I guess Jerry O'Connell did it best because he got the role. So Jerry O'Connell from, of course, Sliders and Lower Decks, right, Brandon?
Star Trek Lower Decks, yes. Do you like that scene?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay.
Public displays of, you know, affection are fine.
Yeah. I think it's a little bit too silly and over the top.
Public pronouncements of love, it's a classic trope in movies. So
Maybe I need to like Tom Cruise's, what is it, Hot Gun? Hot Gun.
Top Gun.
Glue Gun. What is it?
Jerry O'Connell does have a lot of Tom Cruise energy, though. Not to mention it. Jumping on a table. I can see that. So, the only difference here is like it didn't turn like some musical number. You know, if this was a musical, people would just come in and, you know, there'd be lights and all that stuff. But this was just like, if you did this in real life, that's how it would go. Mm-hmm. Now, Jada Pinkett Smith, you know, our friend from The Matrix franchise is in this movie. And she said in a recent interview, quote, I remember saying to the director at the time, I want to die the most horrific death that has ever happened in a horror film. I want it to be long and excruciating. And he's like, cool. And of course, Wes Craven, being Wes Craven, lived up to what they discussed. That is an epic prologue, I think, of her death.
You know what I just watched for the first time?
What's that?
Menace to Society.
You know, I've never seen that.
She's in it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good movie. You should check it out.
Was that before or after this?
Before.
Oh, okay.
A couple years before this. Was this 97? I think Menace to Society was 92, so
okay.
5 years.
Oh, wow,
five
a few years. Years then. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's in, her and Omar Epps are the, you know, the couple at the beginning of this film, and Omar Epps is famous. Well, Major League is our next franchise, by the way, and Omar Epps is in Major League 2 as a recast Wesley Snipes.
Ooh.
And... I have an affinity for Omar Epps and Rice. I'm like, okay, yeah. The recast Wesley Snipes. So
yeah,
I will always think of him that way. So
I thought it was kind of funny that she's all like, you know, like these white people horror movies, and then she's like, I want to go down and see the new Sandra Bullock.
Yeah,
right.
Sandra Bullock. I think he even calls her out in that in the movie too. That was fun. But yes. Now, usually when making a movie, phone calls are faked, right? Actors and actresses like record their lines, and it's all like post-production if it's a voiceover. But Wes Craven had Roger Jackson, who is the voice of Ghostface, on set actually speaking to the actors and actresses on screen, you know, just, you know, voice to voice. Mm-hmm. And when he was on set, he kept him out of sight. He kept Jackson out of sight so no one else could put a friendly face on the voice. And Jackson said that the actors and actresses were intimidated by him and would not talk to him any more than absolutely necessary, except for Sarah Michelle Gellar, who would talk to him on the phone between takes.
That's funny.
So that's what it's like, I guess. That's cool though. Like, they kind of keep some mystique to it, and yeah, he's got a creepy voice. You would never guess, if you ever see a picture of Roger Jackson, you would never guess he's the voice of Ghostface.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, this was news to me. David Warner, who had a short part in this movie, who we know from, of course, Star Trek 5 and 6 and Star Trek The Next Generation. Yep. and lots of other stuff. But, you know, I know from Batman the Animated Series as well. But he had a past relationship with Wes Craven in that he was in, had auditioned for Freddy Krueger in A Nightmare on Elm Street. Can you see him as Freddy Krueger?
No, I can't.
Like, that just shows you how that franchise took a totally different route. Like, you know, the first movie is pretty serious and, you know, like, you could kind of maybe see a guy like David Warner playing him, Freddy Krueger, in that first movie and having, like, a different tone to it. But, like, no way. Like, it just, that just shows you kind of where they started with their idea for that and where it ended up. And I cannot see David Warner running around in a sweater and claws and all that stuff. So, but it was good to see him in this film. Always good to see David Warner.
Absolutely. I know him from Ninja Turtles 2, Secret of the Ooze.
That's right. This guy is the craziest career. And Tron.
Yep, Tron, yep.
This dude, he is nerd royalty. Seriously, if you break it down, if you look at his resume, let me tell you. So, but, you know, speaking of Freddy Krueger, you can see a reference to, much like in the first film, you saw a sweater in Sydney and Hallie's dorm room.
Oh, there's I missed that.
There's a sweater in one of the closets there. It's the Freddy Krueger sweater. And Wes Craven also cameos. He is a man in the background at the hospital.
Okay.
And Matthew Lillard is apparently in the big group frat party scene somewhere in the background. I guess he's not the same character, but he's just back there. So I guess he came to visit that day and they were like, hey, just hang out in the crowd. So, and then Selma Blair is the girl who CC talks to on the phone before Ghostface calls. So. And then finally, Kevin Williamson, these are all cameos here, Kevin Williamson, the writer, he is Cotton's interviewer on TV. Cotton's having his on-screen interview.
Okay.
Now, there's a scene, you know, early on in the movie where Sydney, you know, goes and talks to Randy about, you know, the killings. And he starts talking in an English accent. And then Jamie Kennedy has said that he had no idea, no reason why he did that. They just he did it and they kept it in the movie. So I was like, was this some like Sherlock Holmes thing? Like it was bizarre, but whatever. He's a weird guy, so it's fine. So there was a lot of behind the scenes just leaks and rewrites and chaos here because the cast was not told the identity of the killer until the last day of principal photography. Also, the cast didn't receive the last 10 pages of the script until it was time to film those scenes. And those last 10 pages were printed on gray paper in order to deter duplication. And then all of the cast members were required to sign confidentiality clauses that kept them from discussing the killer's identity in the end of the story. So this was a big deal. You know, so the screenplay was heavily guarded and all this stuff. But then the first 40 pages of the script leaked online. And Kevin Williamson had to rewrite a lot of the movie. And so the film was, you know, going into production without a completed script. And apparently this is one of the extras. So I don't know how they got their hands on a script, but that's how the story goes. Why would you give an extra a script?
Was the internet around in 97?
Yeah.
96?
Dial-up.
Really? Was it?
So,
holy smokes.
So what they did, they ended up almost totally rewriting the script and then sometimes completing the script on the day that those scenes are going to be filmed. And so it was then reprinted on specialty paper to prevent photocopying and then destroyed after use. So, and there's a lot of differences. So in the first draft of the script before it was rewritten, Dewey had transferred from Woodsboro to be on the security staff on campus of the college. So you keep an eye on Sydney, keep her safe. Randy was originally Gail's new cameraman. And Joel was a med student who was friends with Sydney. And then Derek, Jerry O'Connell's character, he was the guy with shooting the documentary. He had walked around with the camera, not Mickey, who's Timothy Oliphant's character. And then Debbie Salt, who we find out is, you know, Billy Loomis' mom, is a lot more aggressive, and she actually gets punched in the face by Gail, Courtney Cox's character, at some point. And then when that happens, this Sydney never slaps Gail. Like, that's your encounter there. And then it was originally going to be "I Will Always Love You," the song sang in the cafeteria there, and it was going to be Mickey singing it to Haley. So it was just all these different things. And then so here's the big thing. The killers were going to be Derek, Jerry O'Connell, Haley, who is Nev Campbell's roommate, and then Debbie Salt, Miss Loomis. So she was the one constant in all this. I thought maybe that was that seems like that could have been something they changed too. Like, oh, let's make her this character and then whatever, right? But then Mrs. Loomis shoots Derek and Haley, and they get stabbed by Cotton. And then Cotton decides, like, you know what? Gail and Sydney ruined my life, and I'm going to get them. So he kills Gail, and then he runs after Sydney, and then both of them, like, die together. So just a totally different ending, and I think it could have worked. But, I mean, before we jump into it here, what do you think of those things, Brian?
That sounds like insanity. Like, that whole thing just sounds crazy. Like, I don't think I would have liked it if it was the boyfriend again. I think that would have been lame had it been her boyfriend again. But Sydney dying, too. Like, you know, these are horror movies, and the final girl always makes it, right?
So. Right. This isn't and, you know, all bets are off in the trilogy, but we're not there yet. This is only the second movie.
We're not there yet.
So, but actually, Kevin Williamson just wanted to say that, like, there were some dummy endings as well in those original scripts to kind of throw people off. So you don't really know what exactly they were going to do, but...
That was a dummy ending that you just read.
There it is. And then probably Dewey would have died in the projection room for being killed, which he probably should have been. It's becoming a trope where it's like Dewey just gets horribly maimed, but he still he still survives. And then there was another idea for the film to end with a shot of another ghost face watching over the campus from a bell tower high above. So that would have been like setting up potentially a third one or adding some mystery to it.
No good. I don't like that either.
I think all the changes they made were for the better when I read all that stuff. But Stab. Right? Stab is the movie franchise inside of Scream, and Robert Rodriguez directed all those scenes. So I thought that was pretty fun. And what is funny is in the first movie, they talk about who would play Sydney if they made a movie, and it was Tori Spelling, and they got Tori Spelling to play Sydney in this movie. So that was pretty cool. Now, this is how big Scream was in the late 90s. It was originally scheduled to open at the same time as Tomorrow Never Dies and Titanic. But both those movies shifted their release dates to not have to go up against Scream 2.
Oh, wow.
That is big time, right? And this is crazy, right? I don't think any other franchise, well, maybe Marvel at this point, but Scream is the highest... but Scream and Scream 2 were both the 1 and 2 highest grossing movies in 1997.
Scream still managed to be the highest grossing in 97?
Yeah, because Scream came out at the end of the year, and so most of its profits were in 97. And then Scream 2 was such a big hit when it opened, it made its most money in 1997.
Wow.
So, there you go.
That's insane.
Take that, Titanic. Now, the movies were different back then. Like, they ran for months and months and months. And I mean, that's how Titanic became number one at the time, because it ran for like a year.
Yeah.
You know, but that's just crazy. Like, I mean, I'm sure there's some superhero movies and stuff these days that can pull that same thing. Like, you know, Captain America 3 and Iron Man 3 and same, you know, whatever, right? But I think that's pretty impressive for the quick turnaround. And only horror movies can have that quick of a turnaround when it's like the same cast and all that sort of thing. So there you go. Scream 2.
How you're trying to expect me to say that Scream made that much money in 97? How are they supposed to do that with a 30-day exclusive theatrical release window before it's on demand?
45 days, right?
What was it, 45?
Before it's on HBO Max.
Before it's on HBO Max. So, anywho. Okay, so let's jump into our discussion of the film. Thank you very much for going through the trivia. Tell me if you want to change the subject, but I want to start with my one thing on this film. Okay, so like I think as we go through this is probably going to be my least favorite, and I think the reason why is because I guessed one of the killers halfway through the movie in the theater the first time I saw it in 97.
Did you guess it was Timothy Olyphant, the guy with the camera?
No, I guessed it was it was Roseanne's sister from Roseanne, right?
But did you guess who she was?
No, because that you can't possibly guess that.
No, that's
that's impossible to guess, but I knew it was her.
Okay.
So when she came out at the end, I was not surprised at all. And so I don't think that, personally, I don't think that was successful. And that's why this remains probably my least favorite of the series.
Interesting. Okay. I felt the opposite. I felt like they, I mean, I like this one just as much as the first, honestly. I think the first one is better. But I think as if you're going to make a sequel to Scream, this is cool. Because, I mean, there were so much like the first one, there are so many characters that could have potentially been the killer, you know? Like, mm-hmm. definitely, like, okay, the boyfriend again. Like, they kept trying to make you think of as Jerry O'Connell. Like, it was just, the camera, like, would stay on him and all these things. And and if it would have been him, that would have been lame. Because that would have been literally, like, God, she has two boyfriends in, like, 2 years, and they're both psycho killers. I was near the end. Well, once people start dying off, you're like, okay, I guess I know who it is at this point, because there's not many people left. Like, especially as soon as they started making out in the projection room and the other documentary started playing, like on the other TV, it was like Timothy Olyphant's Mickey's footage. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, well, he's the killer then. Duh. Okay. But then the good curveball here is Cotton, having him back. Like, Lee Schreiber, mm-hmm. who is, like, you know, a pretty well-known actor. Like, it's funny that he was, like, nothing in the first movie. Like, he's on a TV. And in this, he's, like, a pretty big character. I thought that was cool continuity. And I really was like, yeah, that makes, because he's after fame and he's popping up all the time. Like, I really think he is probably one of the killers. So when he wasn't, I was pretty surprised.
See, and I thought that was a poor misdirect, like right at the end when he came in the final scene and is like, got the gun on the two of them. And he's like, well, I think I can just take advantage of this and whatnot. And I don't know, like, to me, that felt over the top as well. Like, I'd completely forgotten that Timothy Olyphant was the killer in this movie. Right, so I did completely forget about that. But I don't know, like, the Cotton thing seemed like a lame misdirect too late in the movie. Like, I don't know, like, I never.
Well, where he just stumbles in, he's covered in blood. He's like, "Oh, I found Dewey. I tried to help him."
Yeah, there's that. But then even at the final scene too, when he comes in on the stage, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know, like, it felt too little, too late in the film. It felt forced to me.
I don't know, because they had, like, I could, like, when they're theorizing, I think one of my favorite scenes is when Randy is talking to Dewey, and they're talking about the potential suspects.
Yeah.
And Randy's like, well, if I'm a suspect, you're a suspect, so let's move on. And he's like, all right, let's move on.
Yes, I like that, too. That was pretty funny.
That was probably my favorite scene.
You're probably right about that. Let's just move on then.
Yeah, and I was thinking, like, at some point, I was like, I didn't think Dewey was a killer or anything, but I thought, like, is he faking being, like, crippled, and, like, he's going to, like, not be crippled at the end and fight? Mm-hmm. But he wasn't. He really is just crippled. And I guess he gets a little better as things go. I don't know. But I don't think he was a suspect. Obviously, Randy wasn't a suspect, you know, for that scene. But, like, the new cameraman, I was like, maybe he's a guy. Because he like, leaves, and they're all, like, hanging out on the tree. And then immediately they get a phone call talking to them. Like, oh, maybe it's the new cameraman. And then when Randy gets killed in the cameraman van, I was like, oh, maybe it is the cameraman. But it wasn't him. And the girl, the roommate, like, that was one of their original ideas. That makes sense. Maybe somebody who's, I mean, they have to flesh it out, but, like, somebody who's jealous or something. I don't know. Mm. So there were some good suspects here, I think, still.
Yes.
And, but yeah, no one could predict it was, like, Billy's mom
right
at the end.
So it's one of those things where it's like, it's hard because you can guess the killer, but you can't really guess the motivation. You know, like, even in the first one, when it's the boyfriend, you don't guess the motivation is because Sydney's mom slept with his dad, right, and caused his mom to leave, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, like, even still here, like, I didn't like the twist that she's Billy's mom because, yeah, like, Gail Weathers at first, like, she didn't recognize her, but she spent a lot of time with her in the movie, and I know they said she lost 60 pounds and had some work done, but Sydney recognized her instantly as well.
Yeah.
And she's just walking around campus. Had Sydney stumbled upon her at any time in the film?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess
you know,
you're right.
Like, so I don't like that it was Billy's mom as well. I don't know. So, like, this is why this is the weakest one for me, is the killer, her doesn't make any sense. Like, it makes sense that it's her because she's getting revenge for the son getting killed in the first movie.
Old-fashioned revenge.
Old-fashioned revenge. Her
plan is not as 90s.
No, it's just old-fashioned revenge. But it's just, it could fall apart so easily. And, you know, there's a benefit of the doubt in these films, but that's just asking me too much to suspend my disbelief. Because, yeah, if Sydney had seen her at any other point in the film, she would have been like, hey, it's Billy's mom. Hey, Mrs. Loomis.
Well, and that's, I was so surprised to find out, like, that was always going to be part of it. Like, I was like, oh, well, it was going to be Cotton and maybe the roommate, and then they had to, like, oh, let's make, you know, the reporter lady? Let's just make her Billy's mom, and we'll tie that together, right? I mean, to me, that seems like a rewrite, but that was, like, going to be that's the one constant throughout the whole thing, because that felt like, it was, I liked that character throughout the movie when she was, like, Roseanne's sister, but she was, like, wanted to be Courtney Cox's character, wanted to be Gail, you know? And, like, and I love when she was like, listen, local woman. Doesn't even bother to know her name or whatever. Like, I liked that. And you could have just kept her as that character. And I wouldn't feel like it was... She could have never become Billy's mom, and that character still would have been fine.
Right.
Like, you didn't need a payoff to that character.
And that would have been just a red herring. And had it not been her and not been Billy's mom at the end, then it would have been like, oh, one of those false red herrings where you're suspecting somebody who turns out to not be. But, yeah, I'm not kidding, man. The first time I saw it in the theaters, halfway through, I'm like, well, she's one of the killers.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I guess it didn't bother me as much as it bothers you.
Because so she was too much there. For her to just be like a secondary reporter, I'm like, she's got too many lines. They're bringing her back too many times. They're talking to her too much. She's going to be important later on. The only way she could be important is if she's the killer.
Hmm. Well, speaking of people who didn't have a lot of lines, I'm going to say Joshua Jackson is in this for one scene.
Yeah, I was wondering if you noticed him.
I was disappointed. I was like, oh, he's not going to be in more scenes. But he's off busy filming Dawson's Creek, I guess, so he can't be in more scenes. But I like that. You know, again, very meta. You know, they continue the meta commentary about, like, you know, violence in movies and, you know, and society and stuff. And the film class, keeping that going and all that. So I thought that was pretty smart because I'm sure people were saying that same thing about, you know, the Scream movies at the time, huh?
Well, and this scene is just basically us, right? Sitting there talking about sequels to movies, right? And which one's better and which ones hold up and whatnot.
You have a hard-on for Cameron.
Yes. which sequels are better than the original? Godfather 2.
Yeah.
So,
but I got to say, you know, Randy, right? Man, I was like, wow, like that really made me sad. Like he was probably my favorite character in these. And to have him die was like a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, oh, wow, that's like anyone. That made you feel like anyone... No one is
safe. Anyone could go. Nobody's safe.
Right. Well, of course, knowing what I know, because, you know, Scream 5 is coming out, well, I know that Sydney and Dewey and Gail don't die. So I was like, and now I'm like, well, I guess that's really all the big characters now. He's like the last big character they could come. That was pretty shocking, I thought, because he's like your narrator guy about, like, explaining everything and in a fun way. Like, Jamie Kennedy, like, you know, people's mileage may vary on his style of acting and comedy, but I found him very entertaining. And it is funny, like, he's rattling off all this stuff, and he's like, and finally, the last thing, if you want to turn your movies into a franchise, you absolutely never, and then he gets cut off.
Yes.
So I thought that was pretty good.
I wonder what his secret was for the franchise.
But that was a pretty shocking death. And because a lot of these newer people, like Sarah Michelle Gellar, like, is only here to die. You know, she's almost like the... Drew Barrymore, almost in the first movie, right?
Right. Well, you know, speaking of Sarah Michelle Gellar there, I mean, like, going back to the opening scene with Jada Pinkett Smith, she was a big name at the time as well, and she's continuing the tradition of the film where the big name and the big guest actor gets killed off right away.
Well, and I thought that was really clever, too, because it was almost like some commentary on, you know, the role of African-Americans in horror movies and, like, you know, all this, like, and they're mentioning it because the first Scream is not very diverse, you know, so we start off with they're like the only black people there, you know, so that always, they're already, like, talking about that, and then they find a way to, yes, they still kill them off, but the fact they talked about it kind of made it okay, right? And then also, we do have the cameraman later, so it's like they are, like, addressing something that they were lacking in the first one. So I thought weaving all that in was pretty funny. He's like, when did you get a PhD in film studies? She's like, I read my People magazine or whatever. I thought that was pretty funny. I like that. Like, we were, and I guess that's going to be the pattern with these movies, having, like, a prologue, like a death, and then the movie starts.
Spoilers.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. But no, that went on for a long time, you know, and so you're like, you're in one scene with these characters, but you get invested with them, and then he does the Michael Myers thing. He takes the guy's outfit and puts the mask on, and she thinks it's him. Yeah. So which one was that? Must have been Mickey, right?
Yes, exactly.
And why did he kill those people?
I don't know. I don't
kind
have an answer
set
for that
this
one
whole
there.
Thing off, I guess.
Like they were to, yeah, it set it all off, but they were co-students of theirs at the university,
mm-hmm.
right? So they knew them, but I don't know why he picked them. Mm-hmm. Right? So yeah, it's just a way to get it all started and whatnot.
And that's a horrible way to die. Stabbed in the ear through a bathroom stall.
Oh man.
Yikes.
I love it.
That was very effective. It's very creepy too, because like they're passing out all these ghost face masks. Mm-hmm. And so everyone's wearing one. Running around with knives and all that. And yep. Then he goes to the bathroom and like they both like turn around and look at him. it's just kind of creepy, right? Even though those guys weren't killers, they were just guys in ghost face masks. It was creepy. But then I think they even mentioned it later, like, hey, it would have been a hell of a publicity stunt if it was real, because people thought it was a publicity stunt. Like, you're at this horror movie, somebody literally is getting stabbed to death in the audience, and everybody's so hyped up and screaming and yelling, and it's like, it's a commentary on audiences, I guess, right?
Well, would you expect that to be the case? I mean, like, that's a two. Like, yeah, nobody's paying attention because, first of all, that premiere is out of control. Like, what is going on there? Okay, like, get people restrain yourselves. Okay,
people
like
are it's just losing their minds. Like,
what is this? Like, just a group of 4-year-olds? Like, holy smokes! But with them being all out of control and excited, like, they don't realize that something that's happening is real. And what a perfect way. Like, all he has to do then is just take the mask off and nobody knows who the killer is, right? Because they're
right.
Just a bunch of random people that are gone to see this premiere.
Right. Well, and then it is, like, they do gimmicky, they're already doing gimmicky things. Like, they're passing out knives and costumes and all these are fake glow-in-the-dark knives, chasing people around, like, for fun, right? So it mm-hmm. doesn't, you know, that kind of environment, it would not shock you to say, oh, look, we had a fake death to freak out the audience, right? So I can see why people would think that at the time.
Right,
then,
exactly.
Because even people, like, think it's, like, when it starts happening, they think it's, like, a thing. But then she gets up on the, you know, on the stage and falls over. I think everybody finally realizes that this is real. And that was a really effective opening. And then I love how they, like, you know, like, so meta, like, they're making a movie out of the events, which they absolutely would do.
Mm-hmm.
Like Cotton says at the end, it'll make a hell of a movie.
Yeah.
So.
And there, you know, you got those, when Jada Pinkett Smith goes to get the popcorn, you got those women behind her talking, and they're like, this is no good. Like, this is real. People really died.
Right. Which is what people would say. Like, and that's what people do say. So mm-hmm. I just think it was just as smart as the first one, I think, on what it was saying and about the genre, right? Mm-hmm. Like, as far as the plot mechanics, you know, some of the motivations and character reveals are a little, you know. Like I thought it was like the whole Jerry O'Connell thing, right? Where like he gives her his letters and she wears them as a necklace. And because he did that, he gets in trouble with like the fraternity.
Yeah.
So that's a good misdirect, because you see these people in robes running around and you think, oh, Ghostface is going to get him. And no, it's just the fraternity people. And so
fraternity stunt, yeah.
And if I'm going to understand that right, like they have this crazy party and they just were going to hang him up on the stage all night. But then I guess the Ghostface killers came in and...
Yeah, see, like, I didn't...
They didn't do that.
That's another thing, too.
The fraternity did
that.
That.
The fraternity hung him.
Right.
But then they just left him there? Like,
but that's,
so,
that's hazing stuff. Like, that makes sense.
Well, where's the rest of the party? They were just at a party.
Party's over. It's like, I don't know, it's hours later?
I don't know. So, they're going to be partying all night. I don't know.
Oh, man. So. But I got to say, like, one of the most effective sequences... I mean, there are a lot of great stuff in here, but, like, when Ghostface, like, takes over the car. Mm. So first of all, you would not get away with this joke today, but I thought it was hilarious. So like they assign these security guards to Sydney, right? And she's talking to him and stuff, and the friends are talking about him, like, yeah, you know, he's this, he's that, and I think he's gay, right? And then they're in the car, like her and her roommate, because they're gonna go take him to protective custody. The two security guards are, and the detectives are in the front, and they're like, where are you taking us? And one of the detectives says, if we told you, we'd have to kill you. And the other one, who earlier they said was gay, he says, don't ask, don't tell. And then he gets killed immediately by Ghostface. And I think that was the funniest part of the movie. And you would never get away with that today. But I thought it was pretty clever. But yeah, Ghostface driving the car and then them like going off the road and then having to crawl over him. Like that was very, that was very tense.
Yes. Very suspenseful. Like that's one of the best sequences in the film when they're crawling over the body. Right. But it's like you're sitting there thinking, rip the mask off, and she goes to do it and then gets detracted by the fact that she honks the horn. But then also it's like, well, why doesn't she rip the mask off, right?
She does go back to do it even though her friend told her not to, and that ended up getting her friend killed.
So it's all Sydney's fault.
Yes, all this is Sydney's fault, clearly.
Everything's Sydney's fault. So,
but yeah, you got to get out of the car first. You don't want, you rip the mask off, maybe they wake up and then they stab you. You don't know. Which one was that? Was that Mrs. Loomis?
No, all of the death and stuff is Timothy Oliphant. All the killing.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. She just guided him.
So she never dressed up like Ghostface or anything?
No. It's all Timothy Oliphant.
Okay.
That's what I think anyways.
Okay. Yeah. And he really does look like the boyfriend from the first movie. Like, he's got that same vibe to him. So, I mean, that works. I buy that these particular characters would do these things. But okay, that makes sense. It was just the one guy. Because there's not really instances where there would need to be two, like the first movie. So, yeah. Okay.
And you think that there's like a find a serial killer website?
I guess so. She's like, there's only 75 serial killers in the country, and I found one. So that was strange. That is a cliche movie plot, like getting revenge for this or that. And so, I don't know. I could have done without, like I've been saying, I could have done without that. I could have done just with Cotton being one of the guys. Because I would, because he wanted fame. He seemed like he was trying to be nice at the beginning. Like when Gail and goes up to Sydney with the camera, he's like, whoa, she didn't know about this? Like he thought it was like an on the level thing. So you're like, okay, he seems like a decent guy who got screwed over. But, you know, I can see, like, hey, he got sent to jail. Yeah. So I can see why he'd be mad.
Right.
So that I could buy him being one of the killers, especially like he's in all like a black t-shirt covered in blood. I'm like, okay. But that sequence that before that, right, that led to that at the school in the sound booth, that was a great sequence too.
Amazing. Amazing. Absolutely. The way that they were playing with the walls, like the sound walls and stuff that she was hiding behind, and the chase going on, and her standing up and seeing him behind the window, but he couldn't hear her because it's in the sound booth, you know. Oh, I love that sequence. It's really great when they can utilize the environment that you're in a creative way.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not just, let's just do it here because it looks cool. They made it amp up the tension by a significant portion by utilizing where they were.
Right. And pour one out for Dewey, because there's no way he survived that, right, Brandon?
No, we're gonna miss him. I'm gonna miss him. You know, can you believe it? I mean, like they just got married in real life, and then now they're not even in the movie together.
Do you like how they like redid the basically the same beats of Dewey and Gale from the first movie here?
Their relationship throughout the whole franchise is like kind of odd. You know, like, we'll get to that in the next one, but I don't know. It's just, I don't know, man. Like, I don't know if this is how David Arquette is in real life. I just assume this is how David Arquette is in real life. I don't know. I got no idea about the guy. But they seem like the weirdest couple ever.
Yeah, it's true. But, I mean, that's kind of the joke, I guess, right? I
don't know. Super mismatched couple, so it kind of takes me out of it.
Yeah. Well, and I buy Gail's whole thing. She's, like, become a famous writer about this. It's kind of like Dr. Loomis in the Rob Zombie Halloweens, like totally profiting off, you know, this tragedy and stuff. So I buy that, and I buy that, like, you know, they didn't talk after the first one, right? Like I buy that, but it's like the same, like, oh, we do like each other, right?
Yeah,
and then but she has character growth, because instead of covering the story, she goes off on the ambulance with him at the end, Brandon. And that's what true love is.
Yes.
I guess.
I guess so. It depends on what kind of reporter you want to be.
Guess so. That necklace saved Sydney's life, just like Jerry O'Connor told her it would.
Yeah.
Because she threw it at his face.
Scraped his face with it, I guess. I don't know how that would have caused that much injury. It wasn't that big of a necklace. But.
Yeah, not so much. But that is, you know, Timothy Oliphant's character there in that scene, he did have some points. He's like, it's all about the trial. You know, I mean, the late 90s was about OJ and all that stuff. It is true. Mm-hmm. And then the bomb just shoots him. He's like, no, there's not going to be a trial.
So did you go to university at all?
I did.
Were you in a fraternity?
I was not in a fraternity.
You were not?
So I would not know about these activities. So
no Kappa Mappa Zaka?
No Kappa Mappa Zaka. Their names were silly, too, like intentionally so, like Zeta, Beta, Theta. Yeah. That can't be real. I did major in radio, TV, film, and I got to say, they have a much nicer film department. We didn't have a labyrinth of sound booths.
No.
No, like they did.
No, excellent, right on. Yeah, I like this movie. The movie's good. I know I'm crapping all over it, right? I mean, like, but I still love the movie. It's still entertaining. There's still some suspenseful moments. That opening teaser sequence is off the wall amazing. It's really, really good. Every moment of it. I like the movie a lot, right? And I haven't seen the fifth one yet, but I mean, like, I've said it before, I'm 4 for 4 for this franchise so far, and I'm sure I'm going to be 5 for 5 out of them, but I like all these movies. It's just, the plot points take away some of the rating for me, that's all.
That's fair, and I don't have, like, the investment that you do in these, so I'm, like, watching all these fresh, and I'm like, yeah, that was
for the first time, yeah.
Just as good as the first, like, just as entertained, and, you know. Just and to me, I'm looking for, like, the cleverness is still there, you know? I really did like the whole making a movie thing. Mm-hmm. So I guess the next movie they're going to talk about Stab 2.
Hopefully.
That would make sense.
They got to keep going. Got to keep going with the Stab films, right?
So so we will see. But, and Brandon, I have a question for you.
Oh, do you?
I do. What is the phone call count of this movie?
Oh, jeez. You know, I would say 10. I think it's about 10.
That's what I have.
Nice.
Yeah. So, and I'm counting the ones like in the movie as well. So here are the 10 I have. I have the one that's on the screen in Stab.
Okay.
Where Heather Graham plays, what's her name? Drew Barrymore, which I thought was really good casting. Yeah. And what's funny, they got Luke Wilson to play the boyfriend, but Luke Wilson looks more like Dewey. Like, I thought Dewey was played by Luke Wilson when I first started watching Scream. I was like, that's Luke Wilson? So anyway, but that's the first one. The second one is Sydney in the Dorm. Mm-hmm. The 3, 4, 5, and 6 are Omega Beta Zeta. That's the name of the sorority, but that's the ones that all the ones that Sarah Michelle Gellar gets. 7th is Sydney when she's in the sorority house, right, walking around. And then 8, 9, and 10 are all Courtney Cox at the end. So
10, that's a good number. What was the first one? What's our count?
So we had 11 in the first one, 10 in this one, which brings us to 21 for our phone call count.
Way more than the lawgiver count.
Yes. Are we ever going to live that down on this? Like,
no, you're not.
There was one for each movie if you average it out, okay? So that's that's the goal. So
yes. So we're good for the next 18 Scream movies then.
Yes.
If there's never a phone call again,
we're set. I'm sure there won't be any more phone calls.
Probably.
Because who would make them? Because everyone's dead. So I don't. Right. How can you continue? Yeah. But we'll get there in a second. But before there, so Brendan, out of 5 rings?
Rings.
I think that's what we're doing. How many times did you let the phone ring? Or I think that's what we're doing for this one. But out of 5, how many times did you let it ring?
So I'll probably surprise you with how high a number this is, but I'll give it a 4.
Okay.
Because, again, like I said, I like the movie a lot. The movie is a lot of fun. If I was giving halves, I'd probably give it 3.5, right? But it's not a 3. It's definitely better than a 3. So I'm going to give it a 4. How about you? You're going to give this what, a 2?
No, I'm going to give it 5 out of 5. 5 rings.
Whoa,
for me. This is just,
5.
To me, that was just as good as the first one. Like, it was, because I was like, what are they going to do to follow this up?
Jeez.
And they found a way to do it, you know? Nice. Because, I mean, the story was pretty much over in the first one. So, we'll see.
I didn't talk you down.
No.
No? Okay.
Brandon, I love this franchise, unlike you.
Unlike me. Well, I look forward to your next 5 out of 5 rating with Scream 3, because I think Scream 3 is better than Scream 2.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to discussing that with you.
Excellent. Right on. Awesome. Well, let me ask you a question.
Oh.
Is this franchise fatigued?
You know, I'm going to say no now. Because I thought it was after the first one, and they proved me wrong. Mm-hmm. And so for 2 back-to-back 5 out of 5 for me, I can't say it's fatigued now.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure they're clever. they found a way to make something out of nothing, and hopefully they will again. So I'm going to say no.
Yeah, I'm going to say no as well, because, hey, I mean, like, he was about to tell us how they were going to make it into a franchise with a trilogy, right? So
yeah.
You know, it's a good thing, too, because, like, he said, if you want to make it a franchise, so even these people agree, two does not a franchise make.
That's right. This is what we should have referenced in our initial episode.
We should have. I just forgot all about
the Randy rules of franchises. So, oh man. But no, I felt spoken to in this movie by these characters and these conversations, Brandon. So
yeah, it's too bad we won't get any more Randy to talk about how they work with trilogies.
No, I mean, he's dead, so there's no way you can bring him back.
No, definitely not. Excellent. Right on. Well, Zach, where can people find you online when you're not trying to get into the sorority?
Well, you can find me personally on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoronZach. I also host another podcast here on the network, Sasswatch, where Ken Tripp and I look at the multimedia of Bigfoot. And fun and lighthearted look at that topic. And you can find us on Twitter at SasswatchPod. And of course, I host Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that young Superman show. You can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. And Brandon, when you aren't declaring your love to your girlfriend in the cafeteria by singing a song, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me here on the network with a show called Infinite Diversity, which is all about new Star Trek, as well as Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, where my friends Chris and Tom and I cover all of Hitch's films in chronological order. Did Bigfoot go to a university and join a fraternity?
No, he's smarter than that.
Bigga Futa Kappa?
That's... No, incorrect.
No? Oh, okay. Just want to make sure. Thank you so much to all of our patrons for all of your wonderful support. If you want to support us, find us at patreon.com/UFPEarth. Thank you very much to the associate producers of our podcast, David Willett and Casey Pettit. Thank you so much for supporting the network and our show in particular. Thank you so much to Zach Tripp for the wonderful theme music and Tony Robinson for the show art. Find us on Twitter at UFPEarth. Find us on the old-fashioned email, franchisefatigue@UFP.earth. And our Twitter handle for our show is @franchisefatigue. Until next time, when we cover Scream 3... I'll be back.
That is the wrong franchise.
This has been a production of MTMR Media Works.